Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is May 7th, 2026, and this is episode 605. You are listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe, support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warner and hit that subscribe button. I'm the co-host Mark Ames in Western New York State, and I'm on the line with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Butcher in Italia. How you doing, John?
Oh, I'm okay, but I just read stories in the Italian media that China's prognosticator has predicted that the U.S. will lose to Iran, which is one of those easy, easy predictions.
Yes.
That will make you famous, apparently, even if you, like he predicted that Trump would win. And yeah, okay. I mean, have you listened to the Democratic nominee? I mean, God, it's not that difficult. So now he's ready to predict that Iran is going to win, which, mm-hmm. you know, the old saying, every dog in the street knows that.
Yeah.
Every dog in the straight knows that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, calling that at this point is, I don't know.
You could put on a fortune cookie. Imperialists go to war with Iran. And
yes.
Yeah.
And as you can hear, we are joined by friend of the show, Cyrus, coming to us from Beirut. Cyrus, thanks for coming back on Radio Warner.
My pleasure.
Last time you were on, it was about a week and a half into the best name for this war I've seen so far is the 6-week war. In fact, I think Trump today, this is kind of brutal, Trump today posted, he's trying to find a way to spin the war, the lost war, and it's a defeat. Like, he has not been able to find a way to make this not a defeat yet. And so he tweeted something out and said, wow, study this chart, President DJT, and it shows the length of wars. Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, 550 weeks, 450, and then Iran excursion at the bottom, 6 weeks. And so one of the Iranian embassy accounts is the one in Ghana, and their shitposting game is just so good. They like sort of, you know, screen capped it and put it into their tweet, and they write, wow, in capital letters. Indeed, you just showed the world it's possible to pack more humiliation into 6 weeks than America absorbed in its history. You broke the record in how fast a president can be humiliated and beg for applause. The chart is roasting you, Don John. It's just a joke. I don't know what else to say. Like, one of his MAGA, lackeys on social media, Will Chamberlain, which it's always hard. It's like this kind of pencil-necked, you know, cyber geek who's posing as you know, another one of these Nietzsche characters. And he has the name of, like, one of the greatest basketball players ever, you know, tallest dudes ever. He's like little Will Chamberlain. And when Trump announced Project Freedom on Sunday night, he wrote, game over. This is it. Iran has nothing it can do. And a day and a half later, Trump announces it's all, you know, game over for Project Freedom. And he writes, I don't understand what's going on, but I'm just going to have to trust him at this point.
Yeah, that's a smart move.
Yes, yes. So Cyrus, jokes aside, in Lebanon, I mean, this is a multi-front war, we should remind people. It's not just the Persian Gulf or the Strait of Hormuz area. I mean, this is kind of a world war. It has North America involved. It has Asia involved, pretty much all of Asia, and especially Western South Asia. It has Africa involved and even Europe involved. I mean, Cyprus was directly involved. Most eyes, of course, at least in America, are really on what's going on with Iran and the Persian Gulf. But the hottest part, and still hottest part, is Lebanon, where there is a kind of semi-ceasefire that is held up as a semi-ceasefire, but a brutal one for Lebanese. So tell us what's going on there, and, you know, just, I guess, first of all, give us your overall assessment of what's been going on there in the nearly a month since we last talked.
So I wouldn't call it a ceasefire, but Iran imposed on Trump conditions for ending the conflict that Trump then imposed on Netanyahu, partially. So Trump called Netanyahu and insisted that he reduce the attacks on Lebanon. And indeed, we have seen a significant decline in the scope and amount of attacks, not to downplay the fact that they're still blowing up villages, still bombing towns, still killing tens of civilians, but much less and in a smaller part of the country. There was an exception yesterday. They hit a military leader for Hezbollah in Beirut, an assassination. But after the call from Trump, Netanyahu changed the rules of engagement requiring any strike on Lebanon to have his direct approval in order to avoid provoking Trump. And there were statements that the strike last night was coordinated with the Americans. What that would mean would be that they got the permission of the Americans because they would have argued that this is a high-value target that they were hitting, and it wasn't a resumption of the terrible strikes on all of Lebanon.
Right.
So that situation is holding. In general, the conflict is limited to the south, and it is a two-way conflict in that Hezbollah is hitting Israeli soldiers who are occupying Lebanese territory in the south and targeting the northern strip, what Lebanese call the settlements in occupied Palestine, what Israelis would call, obviously, the towns in northern Israel. And it's limited to that, more or less.
Is this like Kiryat Shmona and these towns like that?
Right. They would describe those as being logistical support for the Israeli occupation of the southern strip in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Israelis continue to dismantle towns, basically turning some of the most beautiful towns in Lebanon into parking lots. They have had trouble entering towns on the border until now, which is striking. Hezbollah has definitely adapted its tactics and improved. You've probably seen the use of the
drones
that can't be jammed.
Their drone warfare, the fiber optic ones. Their game has gotten much better. I mean, I remember when they first started using drones and then the first fiber optic drones, you could see that they were still, at least from the ones I saw, they still seemed a little twitchy. They were going in, compared to like the really seasoned users in Ukraine and Russia, they were kind of going in fast and sort of like, you know, not really kind of scoping out the whole situation, just wanting to get that hit before somebody took out the drone. And now you're seeing more recently how they're taking their time with these first-person view of the FPV fiber optic drones. They take their time.
They're almost like a smooth landing for an airliner. Just go into that back door of whatever it is, the M110.
And the Israelis don't seem to have found, like they seem, as somebody said, it seems like they're still in sort of late 2022, early 2023 Ukraine war. Compared to where Russians and Ukrainians are today dealing with drones. Like they don't really, they seem to be starting from scratch trying to find ways to counter these drones. And they're not, the learning curve doesn't seem to be nearly as fast as the Hezbollah offensive learning curve, and at least on the drone end of things.
And it seems to have caused a reduction in their personnel and they're taking extra precautions. That's true. Hezbollah has returned to guerrilla tactics different from what we would have seen post 2006.
Right.
So I don't think we're going to see them using ballistic missiles. They're basically preparing for a long-term occupation. And returning to guerrilla tactics also requires accepting that Israel is going to be occupying your territory.
Right.
And they may have even lured Israel in order to allow for that to happen. The Hezbollah expects that this is going to be a long-term occupation and that this buffer zone strategy that the Israeli military is implementing, not only in Lebanon, is going to persist. And so their priority is to protect the civilians and villages outside this zone and have a war of attrition on Israel inside this zone. this might resemble, it might even be formalized once, if and when an agreement is reached between the Americans and the Iranians, and it might resemble an agreement that followed the 1996 so-called Israeli Operation Grapes of Wrath, which was sometime in the spring of 1996. And I think that was actually the first time we saw the Israelis using mass displacement tactics in southern Lebanon. But the population obviously returned. But in that agreement, in the agreement that followed, it stipulated that neither side would target civilians and that Hezbollah wouldn't use Katyusha rockets or other rockets inside Israel, so the battle would be sort of limited to the occupied zone. And Israel also accepted not to target civilians or civilian targets inside Lebanon. So it set new rules of engagement. And I think we might see something similar happening between Israel and Lebanon if there is an agreement between the U.S. and Iran. If there's not, we might see a resumption of full-scale Israeli assault on Lebanon, which is definitely the preferred Israeli option of all the options presented to them. But for now, Trump is holding them on a pretty tight leash.
Yeah, I would have thought the IDF would be using its most effective tactic, which seemed to be we may not be able to get the people for Hezbollah in the tunnels, but meanwhile, we'll just blow the hell out of Shia neighborhoods in Beirut and see how long your popularity lasts after that.
Right, which is, they definitely did that the last day of the conflict before the Americans imposed the ceasefire on them, or the reduction in fire on them, to be precise. The preferred Israeli tactic right now is to establish buffer zones in the region, which requires those zones to have friendly forces, like the Druze of Sweida in southern Syria, or to have no population or forces, like what they're doing now in South Lebanon. So for sure, the Israelis don't want a return of the population to the south, because that would make it easier for the guerrillas, obviously, to swim within that sea. And as a result, they also don't want any agreement between Israel and Lebanon, because any agreement between Israel and Lebanon would presumably require them to reduce their forces, allow for return of a population, and also reduce their military operations. And the Israelis can't do that right now because it's election season. We expect to have elections there in October or September, and no Israeli politician can afford to look weak. So no Israeli politician will accept any agreement that it shows any sign of weakness or any reduction in Israeli presence. And as a result, the talks that are going on between Israel and Lebanon, which I guess I need to go back and explain that, are not going to lead to any result, because that would be disastrous for Netanyahu, in that it would be perceived as a loss in a conflict, in a regional conflict, where most Israelis already believe they haven't achieved their goals and their ambitions were frustrated, whether in Iran or in Lebanon.
Yes. Are they taking that out on Netanyahu, blaming that on Netanyahu? I mean, I've seen Naftali Bennett, obviously blaming Netanyahu, but Bennett, even though he's supposed to be the kind of the left opposition or left of Netanyahu, he seems to be running to the right of Netanyahu in their...
I think, in fact, Bennett would always be considered, would have always been far more to the right of Netanyahu, because he's ideological. Mm-hmm. While Netanyahu is a cynical opportunist who, at this point, can only retain power by maintaining his alliance with the right-wing crazy people. Mm-hmm. Although, at this point, in Israel, everybody's a right-wing crazy person. But so there's a spectrum, but he would never be considered center. He was a right-wing extremist. Okay. He's a religious fundamentalist, which is different from Netanyahu, who is personally a secular individual.
Right.
And he has more recent experience fighting in Lebanon. He was an officer in a special forces unit and was involved in attacks on civilians, I believe, actually in 1996, in fact, in the Grapes of Wrath operation.
What was the Grapes of Wrath operation again?
this was what the Israelis called their spring 1996 operation. They were already occupying South Lebanon, of course, but they led a massive operation which cleared the population from the south briefly and was meant to displace Hezbollah, which failed, and ultimately the Israelis withdrew in the year 2000. So
right.
The Israeli occupation from 1982 to 2000 persisted. 96, Grapes of Wrath, was just a major operation within that period.
So similar to what's going on now, trying to ethnically cleanse Shia villages. This is a predominantly Shia area, but also Christian,
then,
or no?
Right, there's Druze and Sunnis, but it's majority Shia. Mm-hmm. It was back then, it wasn't meant to be a permanent displacement.
Okay.
They hadn't yet adopted that strategy. So the population quickly returned.
Right.
I think that's also when there was a very famous Qana massacre, when they hit displaced Shia civilians in a refugee center in a southern town called Qana. And I believe that Bennett was involved in that as well. But anyway, certainly he would be on the right side of the spectrum. He and other opposition figures in Israel have criticized Netanyahu for his operations, not for doing them, just for, I guess, not for winning.
Right.
So they haven't proposed an alternative. They were all obviously cheering war with Iran.
Yes.
They would support the continued occupation of Syria and the hostility to the new Syrian regime. And obviously they would support any acts of violence against Palestinians and Lebanese. They just would just say that we would do it better. Not so different maybe from the Democrats, Chuck Schumer and others mm-hmm. in the U.S. when it comes to criticizing Trump.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the questions that keeps bothering me about the Israeli political situation. First of all, is there anything like a peace party in Israel, and what kind of support does it draw?
No, I would say, first of all, polls show that the overwhelming majority of Israelis are extremely hawkish. Mm-hmm. And peace, well, first of all, peace with who? If you start with the Palestinians,
right.
then no. Then nobody supports even the two-state solution, the Oslo peace process. Obviously, there has always historically been a fringe left, hard left, anti-war camp in Israel, a bunch of secular hippies who have had no significance. They might go to protest every Saturday in front of the Ministry of Defense in Tel Aviv. And they tolerate the existence of a few writers in Haaretz, the mm-hmm. left-wing newspaper like Gideon Levy or Amira Haas, but they have no social base and no influence, and the mainstream media would be perceived as fascist. They might be secular. The real divide in Israel isn't so much left and right or hawk or dove. It's just secular or religious, but they tend to agree. So the secularists may not support the full annexation of the West Bank because they don't have the same notion of greater Israel, and they wouldn't want to be in control of more non-Jews. So there's nuances, but it doesn't mean that they would support peace. They wouldn't view the Palestinians as wanting peace. To them, peace would mean subjugation. Mm-hmm. The Israeli
right.
definition of peace, or the interpretation of it, is surrender and subjugation.
Yeah.
Not any kind of justice or equal rights or parity between the two sides.
Yeah, total.
So I had another question, sort of a long-term one that I've wondered about many times. Does Lebanon just accept the stress, or parts of Lebanon accept the stress of having a big population suddenly forced to move into houses that are already inhabited? Where do they go?
Well, in Beirut, you still see people in tents around certain parks, for example. So there is a massive displacement crisis, and most of the displaced Shias have preferred to stay in Beirut or as close to their original homes as possible, unlike in the past where we've seen them going up to mountains and even up to the north, or in the more distant past, 2006, going to Syria, which is not an option now because the genocidal Sunni regime in Syria is not going to welcome Shias with open arms, more like the Lewis Carroll poem, with gentle smiling jaws or something like that.
Yeah.
So they, as soon as they had a chance to return to their towns when this Iran-imposed reduction in violence took place, those who could did. Although last night after the assassination strike in the southern suburbs, you saw a renewed displacement because people panicked that the war might start again. But I think they realized this was a one-off assassination. There's many people who are in schools. You had about 1 million people displaced in the Israeli war on Lebanon. And obviously many of them will never go back to their homes, or at least not for many, many years, because Israel intends to maintain its possession of this southern strip. And they've been very sedulously blowing up house after
Gazifying
house.
Gazifying it. They're Gazifying it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Hezbollah is keen, obviously, to maintain the support of its population and care for their needs. Ideally, they would be kept as close to their original homes as possible. And they're going to have to find ways to provide for them. It's a challenge for Hezbollah because they're financially strapped. There has been a campaign to limit their access to funds even before the war on Iran. For example, direct flights from Iran to Lebanon were halted upon Israeli demand during the 2023-2024 first escalation of the post-October 7 conflicts, or the first phase. And until now, there are no direct flights, so you have to fly, if you're going from Iran or to Iran from Lebanon, either via Iraq or via Turkey. And there's a bit more stringent control over the border, over the airport, rather. And Syria is not entirely off limits as a logistical source, but it's far more difficult. However, the resistance axis has benefited from the chaos and corruption in Syria, so they can still smuggle some personnel and devices, and maybe even cash, I don't know, back and forth from Iraq or Turkey towards Lebanon. I have a feeling, a bit more than a feeling maybe, that Turkey is tolerating the smuggling of support to Lebanon from Iran to Turkey through Syria to Lebanon because the Israelis have been very vocal and overt about their intention to go after Turkey next.
Yeah.
Turkey is a bigger threat than Iran, that kind of language. They've been very hostile. Now, they would say this is because of belligerent statements made by Erdogan and his relatives after the fall of the Syrian regime in 2024, that after Damascus, Jerusalem is next. Erdogan called Netanyahu Hitler, and Netanyahu took that personally, obviously.
Yeah.
There's been a general escalation in Turkish rhetoric towards Israel, but no actual action taken. And the general fear that Turkey supports Sunni extremists, and Syria is now controlled by those extremists. So from an Israeli point of view, Turkey's on our border, and we're going to have to take action against them. So it would be in the interest of Turkey to also have its own proxies or support anybody who is going to distract Israel or give it a hard time.
Right.
So they might be tolerating some of this as well.
Pinning Israel down. I have a quick question about what the IDF strategy is in this buffer zone below the Litani River. That's where the buffer zone is, right? And then they seem to be doing a little bit beyond the river, but they're trying to create it south of the Litani. If the goal, I think, if I understand it right, is to cleanse every Shia village or every person from this buffer zone, every Lebanese person, and destroy all structures and make it uninhabited and uninhabitable. And if they do that, or unless maybe there is such a large non-Shia population that maybe that's not possible, but if it is possible, if something close to that is possible, is the idea that Hezbollah can't operate there, or is the idea that the IDF won't need to put actual personnel? I mean, I would imagine they're thinking, how do we create this buffer zone where we need as few or close to zero actual Israeli personnel to, you know, to monitor and to hold this territory and occupy it, because it's a human wasteland, and, you know, covered from the air by air power and drones.
Yeah, you would no longer even need a collaborationist local force the way they had the Southern Lebanese Army, the Lahad Army, during the 1982 to 2000 occupation period, because there would be no civilians to control and no insurgents to look for among those civilians. So there were, and there still are a little bit, non-Shia communities living in the south. It wasn't homogeneous, Druze, Sunni, and Christian. The Druze fled towards the Bekaa Valley, where there's safer Druze towns. Many of the Christians have fled, not all of them. Israel initially tried to reassure them that they were safe, although it also conducted strikes on Christian towns. And even killed a priest. It also warned them not to allow any displaced Shias to enter their towns. But life also becomes unviable when you're like the one village remaining in a wasteland. Yes. And there's nobody to trade with, and you're nobody to communicate with. So the people remain in a few of these villages. But effectively, as you said, the strategy is to destroy all civilian infrastructure and military infrastructure, which would include tunnels, of course.
Right.
And we've seen that Hezbollah has been able to operate in these zones and to return from zones where it was perceived to have been cleansed.
Mm-hmm.
So they are initially, after the 2024 war on Hezbollah, when the leadership was decimated, they had trouble communicating with the fighters in the south. The fighters kept on going on autopilot because they're locally based cells, but Hezbollah has been able to restore that, and now they've maintained lines of communication between the leadership, which is hiding presumably in Beirut, and the fighters in the south, and they've even been able to replenish them with supplies, new technology, as we've seen with some of these drones, and replace personnel. So somehow they've become much more effective, and they've learned from their mistakes. There's also been far fewer assassinations of officials. Part of that is maybe because Israelis just don't know who is who, but also obviously they're a learning organization, Hezbollah, and this younger generation has learned to adapt, learned to stay underground, and nobody really knows who are the leaders that you would go after.
Mm. And I would think too that the Israelis had built up some really valuable intelligence sources, human intelligence sources and electronic, that were then used, you know, those cards were played in 2024 to pretty devastating effect. But it takes a while to build that up again, if that's even possible. And a lot of the reason, at least from what I've read, that they were even able to penetrate Hezbollah so successfully in, you know, up through 2024 had to do with how Hezbollah really kind of extended it or overextended itself in the Syria war. And that's
they got arrogant. The leaders were maybe older men who were unfamiliar with modern technology, maybe also older men who didn't mind the idea of martyrdom, and so it took less precaution. And now you have a younger generation who are the military wing of the movement is more dominant now, and they also seem to have adapted to the threat. So they're responding remarkably effectively this time around. They surprised everybody.
Yes. But I wonder if you think it is possible. I mean, just from pictures I've seen, I suppose you've been there, southern Lebanon, like a lot of Lebanon, but southern Lebanon looks like very guerrilla-friendly terrain. You know, jagged hills, you know, interspersed with villages, a lot of foliage. So it's like, you can look at it on a map, but when you're actually there, it's a lot of very hard to control space, I would think. I mean, I would think if you're a guerrilla, it's pretty good terrain for you. And so even if the Israelis think they've cleared an area, I mean, it seems to me it's going to be hard to fulfill even this really kind of Nazi and Belarusia, you know, plan of theirs for control of that area.
Definitely when Trump is restraining them a little bit.
Yes.
I mean, they have been able to destroy the towns on the Southern Strip. From their point of view, ideally, they would expand that area of destruction further and further.
Yes.
And also punish Beirut.
Yes.
And that's unacceptable to the Iranians. And the Iranians and their allies, whether in Iraq or Yemen, are not going to give up on Hezbollah.
Right.
That seems to be a principle that they're going to stand firm on no matter what. So the Israelis will have some success just turning the closest strip to the Israeli border into a desolate wasteland. But they won't be able to get much further than that, it seems, for now, unless there's a full resumption of the conflict and they're unleashed again. But you're right, these rocky mountains and valleys and hills in southern Lebanon are ideal territory for a defender if indeed Israel tries to expand its ground penetration.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the free fire zones, as they were called in the Vietnam War. There was a lot of hope for them, as in we'll just ban anybody from being alive in that area. And if they are alive in that area, we'll shoot them or kill them in any other way we can. And that didn't work out so well. One of the powers that a very wealthy occupying force has is money to distribute. And the Americans often said, you know, like, we were better off bribing people to turn their neighbors in than just turning the area into a wasteland.
They have been good at using money to bribe Lebanese in general into turning against, into turning into collaborators, even right. within the Shia community. The economic crisis has definitely helped them do that. Hezbollah guys have complained about that to me in the past, that the Israelis are taking advantage of our economic crisis. And surely in Iran, we see the same thing. But the new Israeli doctrine post October 7 is one where they will not accept any threats close to their border.
Right.
So they don't have to win hearts and minds for that. They just need to scorch
right.
the border.
Yeah.
And maintain occupation just as they're doing in most of Gaza, much of southern Syria, and now Lebanon. I think this is a policy which they can maintain in the short term, at least.
The last time we talked, you said that it looked like one Israeli goal was to maybe try to incite a civil war. And that doesn't seem to have worked at all. You didn't think it would work either. But what is happening at the kind of political level, the national political level?
So Hezbollah would like to avoid internal conflict at all costs. As a result, they've been very disciplined in the recent years, even before October 7, certainly after, in avoiding, controlling their population and avoiding provocations. These provocations have mainly come from right-wing Christian parties, especially the Lebanese forces. In the past, more distant past, 10, 15 years ago, some of these provocations came also from Sunni parties, but now Sunni-Shia relations are not so bad in Lebanon. So a civil war would happen if Christians were able to revive their militias and attack Shia areas, but that's not an option. I mean, right now, the party that could fight a civil war, Hezbollah, doesn't want one. The party right. that might want a civil war, the right-wing Christians, can only fight a war on TV. They have a few talking heads
right.
who make threats on. There's four TV stations that at this point are promote the minority right-wing Christian position in Lebanon, but they have no people on the ground to fight.
Right.
So there's no risk of a civil war with the Lebanese parties. There were concerns about the Lebanese army getting dragged into a conflict. There's been a lot of pressure
yes.
for like a year now on the Lebanese army to take action.
Yeah, hasn't Tom Barrack been pushing them to do that? That was like part of the big plan to get the Lebanese
army. The U.S.
army.
Government has been pushing them. Yeah, the Americans have been pushing for many years, in fact.
Yeah.
The Lebanese army can be perceived as America's tool in Lebanon, much like it had sort of been in Iraq, is in Jordan also. The Palestinian security forces at some point could have been seen like that as well, right, because the U.S. provides so much support for the Lebanese army. The commander of the Lebanese army made it clear last August that he's not going to take any military action against Hezbollah because he doesn't want to have conflict with them. And this is not only because of Shias. Much of the army, regardless of their sect, Sunni or Christian or Druze, would also not want to fight their brothers, their Shia compatriots. And they're also all hostile to Israel. The Israelis have killed many Lebanese soldiers in this conflict and the last one. The ideology of the Lebanese army, to the extent that it has one, that its creed, views Israel as an enemy. And a lot of the soldiers who joined the army didn't join in order to fight. They joined to have a salary and health benefits for their families. Mm. So they're certainly not going to get involved in a conflict with Hezbollah. And obviously Hezbollah is much stronger and more effective as well. So I don't think there's a risk of civil war. There has been increased risk of civil violence because the Americans have been pressuring the Lebanese president, Joseph Aoun, to go to Washington to meet with the Israelis. So this would be a red line, at least for the Shia parties in Lebanon, and it would mean the end of the post-civil war Taif system, a consensus-based system where Shias and Christians and Sunnis, and Druze to a certain extent, operate within, as I said, within a consensus. And this would be done in defiance of the Shias and would mean the end of Taif. It wouldn't mean a civil war, but it would just mean that the whole Lebanese system would fall apart. And if Aoun were to go to Washington and meet Netanyahu, he wouldn't be able to deliver anything anyway, because the Israeli demand would be disarming Hezbollah, and the Lebanese army is incapable of doing that and unwilling to, as I said, to do so. I don't think that Aoun is going to go to Washington, but the Americans are really pushing for it. They didn't want it to look like the ceasefire in Lebanon happened as a result of Iranian pressure, which it obviously did, because Iran linked its cessation to a cessation on Lebanon.
Right.
And so they needed, and you know, Trump likes these bullshit agreements that lead to nowhere. You remember how many times he said he ended a 3,000-year conflict between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza,
right. Yes.
And predicted all kinds of great things for Gaza. Hamas is not disarmed, and Israel has not withdrawn from Gaza. So the Israelis are placating Trump, as they have done in the past, because he's this annoying old man that asks you to do stuff, and so they play along. And the Lebanese are also playing along, but they are in a bit of a weaker position, obviously. But it was outrageous for many Lebanese that while the Israelis are bombing our country, directly targeting journalists and civilians, government's delegation is meeting with the Israelis, which is, technically speaking, also a violation of Lebanese law, but also just an insult to the Lebanese who are under Israeli fire. That won't provoke civil conflict because, as I said, Hezbollah is so keen to avoid that at all costs and can't afford to be distracted as it's fighting Israel by dealing with delegitimizing internal conflict. So no, I don't think there's any risk of civil war in Lebanon. Just further pauperization as the country suffers from so much of its infrastructure and economy being damaged, and the miseration of the displaced Shias. But they are also committed. The Shia population, much like the Palestinians of Gaza, are ideologically committed to their struggle for national liberation and their struggle against Israel. And they have a built-in mythology that allows them to justify fighting injustice and suffering and sacrificing when fighting injustice.
Right.
Thanks to the stories of the Battle of Karbala, and the sacrifice of Imam Hussein against the Umayyads. And they also, the population is being pushed to embrace Hezbollah because the government is so stupid that they've made Shias feel further isolated and marginalized. So as I think I've said before, in Syria you have this Sunni extremist regime that's taken over,
right,
whose clerics and leaders and media use genocidal language when it comes to Shias and Alawites and others. And they've seen what happened to Druze and Alawites already in Syria. So they're afraid of them on their eastern border. You have the Israelis using genocidal language and tactics. And internally, you have a Saudi and American imposed president and prime minister who have done everything to make Shias feel isolated from the rest of the country and as if their own government views them with hostility. So that's pushed them even further to view Hezbollah and the weapons of Hezbollah as their only protection from enemies everywhere.
Yeah, the Israelis really, I doubt they had any goodwill at all going in, but they really radicalized the situation in a, I don't think they care, I guess, because what they care about is their own domestic politics, but they certainly radicalized, I would think, the sort of domestic Lebanese political situation in a way, you know, against Israel more. I mean, just referencing what the Israelis did the day after the ceasefire, that Trump ceasefire deal with the Iranians, the Israelis went on just on a murder rampage and killed 350 some odd Lebanese up and down Lebanon or from central Lebanon on down. And they murdered, it was assassination. They've been assassinating paramedics and reporters, and one of the reporters they murdered was a very, it's as far as I can tell, was a pretty popular Lebanese, or certainly within the Shia community, journalist who had been targeted, knew she was targeted by the Israelis, but continued reporting, and then was bombed in her car, and then double and triple tapped when she went into a house to try to hide.
Yeah, Amal Khalil, who worked for a secular leftist newspaper called Al Akhbar, which is sympathetic to the resistance, but it's not a Hezbollah newspaper, and has criticized Hezbollah in the past. Obviously, it has, as I said, this secular leftist orientation. But she was hunted down, and they threatened her. They made her know she was a target. She published these statements, and they kept on hunting her down, and they killed her. But you said that the Israelis have turned much of the Lebanese population against them. It's such a divided country that for much of the population, this war is happening in a different country. Mm. And not to our people, but to strangers, to outsiders. Mm. There isn't a consensus in Lebanon on what it means to be Lebanese, on who is the enemy, on what foreign policy should be. There never has been, going back even to when the resistance was leftist or was Palestinian. So it remains a very divided country. And obviously we can see that because the government itself.
Right.
Now, members of the government view Hezbollah as an illegal organization and have made its weapons illegal. They can't do anything about it. So they've stupidly escalated and are unable to implement their threats. But it's caused deep divisions, which I think no matter what happens, whether Hezbollah wins or loses, the officials who internally who declared war on Hezbollah will pay the price for that. Because even if Hezbollah were to be weakened as an external threat to Israel, Shias are still a plurality, and Hezbollah will retain its weapons that are useful for an internal conflict. And in the worst case scenario, would be prepared to go after its internal foes who are perceived to have betrayed it when it and its population were being brutally attacked by the Israelis.
Right.
That's a really good point, because I can think of other struggles where anyone who is perceived to have helped cause the defeat of an armed movement is considered a perfectly good target if the foreign enemies can't be hit.
Yeah. So Let's move to Syria right now. Let's move next door. You've been mentioning it, and then later I'd like to ask about Iraq. But we don't hear actually a lot about Syria. Since this war started, there was some talk early on that Syria might sort of indirectly or directly join hands with the Israelis to kind of pincer Hezbollah from the east. And that didn't happen. And the other thing I think I was telling you before the show, the Israeli government account, Twitter account, it's the Israeli government's one. It says snow in May in Israel, and then a symbol of snow and a symbol of the Israeli flag. Mount Hermon surprises as so. It's just openly claiming Mount Hermon in Syria and part of now, Israeli-occupied Syria. We're not even talking about Golan, the Golan Heights, which were annexed, but further in. What is happening in Syria? What's happening with Jolani's rule there and with the minorities and, sort of where are they on the war or do they even have time for it?
So just on to start with Syria in relation to the recent conflict and to Israel, when the new Syrian regime took over in December 2024, their priority was to improve their international standing because they had to remove sanctions and remove the terrorist designation on the leadership. As a result, they knew that the number one leader they had to seduce was Donald Trump, because only he could remove those sanctions, and only he could also restrain Israel, which immediately after the fall of the regime bombed Syria hundreds of times to destroy what was left of the Syrian military, so that HTS, the former Al-Qaeda organization which took over Damascus, would not have access to that military and would therefore wouldn't presumably pose a threat to Israel. So Trump and his envoy to much of the region, Tom Barrack, pushed them to meet with the Israelis, and they kept on trying to say the right stuff to get Israel off their back. Obviously, they couldn't completely sell out. This is a movement which is still an ideological movement and still views Israel as an enemy, and much of its population does. And there's also an Arab consensus, a Saudi-backed Arab consensus, which the Emiratis and Bahrainis might have broke. But the King Abdullah peace initiative, I think from the year 2000, which I should have mentioned. I'm sorry, if we just go back to Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Another reason is the Saudis are pressuring the Lebanese not to make a deal with Israel because the Saudis view themselves as the leader of the Arab world who will help have a unified Arab position when it comes to peace agreements with Israel. And they resent the fact that the Emiratis broke that consensus. Likewise, they wouldn't want the Syrians to make a separate peace either, but the Syrians can't. They were hoping at least to return to the post-1974 armistice agreement that had kept the peace between Israel and the former Syrian regime. Now, both the Israelis and the Syrians were going along with Trump's demand that they have meetings, and they did have meetings in Paris, and I think in Azerbaijan, where not much was discussed, but the Israelis basically imposed their conditions on the Syrians, which were buffer zone in the south and don't come close to Sweida, the majority Druze province. But there's no chance of an actual agreement. The Israelis view the new regime in Syria as a major threat. And as soon as Israel finishes with Iran, I think they're likely to turn more of their attention onto Syria, where you have, from an Israeli point of view, a regime in charge which is worse than Hamas, and a population which is overwhelmingly hostile to Israel, and much of the new Syrian security forces are also very vocal about their opposition to Israel. And in military parades, they chant for Gaza and Hamas and jihad, which is hardly reassuring to the Israelis. So there won't be a deal, but there is this...
But what would they do? I mean, because Shiraz Jolani is weak, and he is absolutely playing ball with well, with Washington and Europe. So what would the Israelis do? Would they want to
undermine him? Yes, they would. They would like to undermine him because a successful Syria under this current regime is also a long-term regional threat from an Israeli perspective.
So you don't want him to centralize power. You don't want him to be able to build the state up. Okay.
Because not because of Syria alone, but because from their point of view, a successful Syria will be a model for other Arab Muslims, especially in Egypt and Jordan, where the population is overwhelmingly hostile to Israel and dictatorships keep it in place. Right. A populist regime in Syria, is a popular Islamist semi-jihadist regime in Israel, in Syria, would be a nightmare scenario, especially one which is backed to a certain extent by Turkey, a NATO ally that you can, of the U.S., so you can't even attack them directly.
Right.
So I think if it wasn't for Tom Barrack, who's such a close interlocutor with Trump, Israel might have bombed the shit out of Damascus and killed Ahmad al-Shara with Muhammad al-Julani long ago. Wow. The guy that's keeping the system alive right now, I think, is Tom Barrack, because he has the ear of Trump. Now, there were rumors, there was even a Reuters article that claimed that HTS was intending to attack Lebanon and go after Hezbollah.
Yes.
This seems to have been psychological warfare, because there was never such a plan. There was, the HTS regime in Damascus did send forces to the border in order to reassure the Israelis that they're not going to allow for Hezbollah to use Syrian territory for its personnel or for smuggling. But they don't have an army that could actually attack Lebanon. They have guys on pickup trucks because the Israelis destroyed what was left of the army.
Right.
And the Lebanese army might be...
So it's still configured like a militia group, basically, like an insurgent.
It's a collection of many militias. Yeah, they have not been able to institutionalize their security forces at all. And it's a very weak chain of command. But none of them, none of the groups that make up the Syrian Ministry of Interior or Ministry of Defense are capable of posing a threat to Lebanon. What they can do is send suicide bombers. I mean, they definitely have experts in that kind of thing. But there was never an intention. The various benefactors of the new Syrian regime, the Saudis, Emiratis, and Turks, have all stressed that they don't want Syria to engage in any foreign adventures. The new Syrian president, Ahmad al-Shara, is determined not to get Syria involved in any foreign adventures. He doesn't even control all of greater Damascus, let alone all of Syria. So the notion that he would have a conflict with Lebanon is absurd. And the Lebanese army, weak as it is, and prevented as it is from fighting Israel, would not be restrained when it comes to fighting a threat from the Syrian border. And they have engaged with threats from the Syrian border in the past, albeit with Hezbollah's help as well, in this period of like 2013, 14, 15, when Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS were not only on the border, but even occupying parts of the Lebanese side. And the Lebanese army received intelligence and military support from the Americans and British to fight the very guys who are now in charge of Syria. So anyway, I think there was never an intention on the part of the Syrian regime to attack Lebanon, and there was certainly never an ability to do so. And if they would like to find a modus vivendi, because it's so crucial for economic reasons as well, and the new Syrian regime is, and the new Syrian state is so fragile, and there's no sign of it becoming more of a state. The economy is devastated, and they've adopted extreme neoliberal policies which have made things even worse. So whatever socialism and subsidies were left over from the former Syrian regime, they removed those, making electricity, for example, much more expensive, bread much more expensive.
Right.
And they opened the borders and flooded the country with cheaper Turkish manufactured goods, which devastated
out local
what
industry.
Was left.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Which had already been heavily damaged from the war.
Right.
And now you can't compete with Turkish goods. You have to pay your employees more because the cost of living in Syria has gone up so much, and it's very expensive to produce because electricity has gone up so much. So the economy is really suffering, and nobody's crazy enough to invest in shithole Syria right now because it's unstable. The state sponsor of terrorism designation has not been removed by the U.S., even though I think it's unfair. It's more of like a terrorist-sponsored state than a state sponsor of terrorism. there are no institutions that can absorb foreign investments. The Central Bank and Ministry of Finance and The government institutions are in disarray and controlled to a large extent by, not by technocrats, but by bearded sheikhs from Idlib who came down in the insurgent offensive of December 2024. So the economy is destroyed and there's just enough money coming in from expats and from some taxes in the ports to maintain a minimum so people aren't starving. And of course, there's a huge population outside that sends remittances, and that helps as well. The Saudis and Qataris had been paying some of the civilian salaries, but I think that stopped as well. And the Gulf will be hard-pressed to support Syria after what's happened. I mean, I think the Qataris have had to reduce their budget by 17% due to damage they've suffered. Everybody is now turning inwardly in the Gulf.
Right.
And so they'll be even less likely to be magnanimous.
Their money is drying up. I mean, it makes sense. So, it seems like the Jalani regime is, incredibly shaky and could be easily toppled, but there isn't, I doubt there's probably an organized movement and or a sponsor of such a movement to topple Jalani with somebody else. So it's just, everyone's just going to kind of suffer.
Well, with the exception of the IDF, but at the moment, they're not permitted to do that, as I understood you to say. But a more general question on the IDF is, how much do they think they can do? I mean, they must be straining their infantry capacities right now.
And the Israeli economy, for that matter.
Yeah. How are they going to occupy?
They would say the Israeli economy seems to be doing surprisingly well. Mm. I mean, it's a European-level economy. So I guess mainly due to the high-tech and military sectors. Mm-hmm. So they haven't suffered economically enough for that to make a difference. The population seems to be willing to accept never-ending wars. And I think this is one of the things that surprised many observers, including myself, when October 7 happened. A lot of us thought that this is a spoiled bourgeoisie population in the service sector. They don't want their kids to be in the special forces anymore the way that Ehud Barak's generation did. They want their kids to be in the high-tech sector of the military so they can go on after they serve in the military to work in the private sector. As it turned out, the fascist roots of Israel were able to reassert themselves, and they have been able to endure a long war. They've been able to endure weeks or months of going down to bomb shelters when there's air raid sirens. They've been able to endure the pariah status that they increasingly face internationally. And I think it's justified their narrative, the whole Zionist narrative that everybody hates Jews, there's no safe place but Israel, and our enemies only understand force. Mm-hmm. So you would have thought, I mean, logically, after October 7, there might have been a leader who would say, Jesus Christ, these people hate us. They're always going to hate. They're going to hate our children. They're going to hate our grandchildren. We have to find a modus vivendi with them. We can no longer continue to live. We need to find a way to coexist with our neighbors rather than have this iron wall, or now this wall of fire around us. And that you might see a de Klerk kind of figure like in South Africa, or somebody wise enough to call for not yet for once a solution for equality, for justice, but there is no such figure in Israel. There might be some fringe leftist intellectual or something like that. But the population, the security forces seem prepared to endure long-term or never-ending conflict, especially as long as they're basically winning for now. They're not suffering high casualties. There's not really any risk of another October 7 happening.
When you were describing the ambitions of the Israeli security state. And you said there's some people who think about occupying Syria, and then I may be paraphrasing wrong, but and then continuing to Turkey, and that was surprising. I can't imagine an Israel-Turkey. Well, I can't imagine it happening because they're both inside the U.S. hegemony. But if it did, the Turkish army, I would think, is no joke.
Right. So I'm not suggesting that Israel wants to occupy all of Syria. They obviously lack the personnel to hold that much territory. Yeah. Or that they're going to launch attacks on Turkey today. But there are other ways they can sabotage Turkey's internal situation. And they have also threatened to attack Turkish bases were they to be established in central or southern Syria. So they will only tolerate Turkish military presence in northern Syria. And they would hit a Turkish base. The Turks had wanted to have bases in Homs, in central Syria. Mm-hmm. And Israelis said that they would target those bases even if there were Turks inside them.
Wow.
I don't think at the moment we can envision a conflict with another NATO ally. But if Trump were to withdraw from NATO, then that could change. Turkey doesn't have, I think, the kind of ballistic missiles that Iran does that would be a major threat for Israel. But we're far from a direct military confrontation. We might see skirmishes in the future. But there's no direct, there's no Turkish military presence that is now on the front line with the Israeli military. There's only what the Israelis would see as proxy forces, various Syrian Sunni militias.
Okay.
I think that they can continue in this situation for a long time. They don't seem to be suffering. And in fact, they have drawn a conclusion that they can't afford to be so dependent on the U.S. or on the Europeans for missiles or for ammunition. So there is a push for greater self-sufficiency when it comes to military production as well, in the event that they lose support from some of their steadfast allies.
Right. But Israel is not loaded with resources. I mean, I guess they could source resources from other countries, but it's. I guess they could do it. And now that I think of it, they could. They'd have to really kind of retool their whole economy to some manufacturing. I don't think they do much manufacturing anymore.
Right. They are relatively self-sufficient when it comes to energy, thanks to gas, and they still remain key economic partners of the European Union. Mm-hmm. In fact, something which is just shockingly fucked up, the Europeans just threatened Israel with sanctions, not because of genocide or war or anything like that, but because they were going to buy grain from the Russians that was perceived to be Ukrainian grain.
Right. It was grain that they thought that was harvested from Russian-occupied Ukraine, and that's when the Europeans put their foot down. Yeah. Nobody believes in anything anymore. All right, well, let's move on to Iraq then. Because Iraq was, it seems to me, like the least understood theater in the six-week war and after, and yet it was very hot part of the war. And as far as I can tell, the U.S. has been driven out of much of Iraq, if not all of Iraq, and NATO as well. And we're getting next to no reporting about what actually went on. As I understand from you, Cyrus, it seems to me that the Americans didn't really know. It's kind of surprising given how much time Americans have been there that they really didn't know who they were hitting or who they hit. And they made things significantly worse when they started, you know, undertaking military operations in Iraq. Is that true?
Yes. If I can just add one more point about Syria, because we were discussing the economy and the weak government. Another very important factor is the rise of a Sunni extremist culture at a popular level and at the institutional level. So it's become routine to agitate for genocide against Alawites and Druze and others. And you still have daily killings of Alawites in particular in Syria. We're not at the same high levels of massacres that we saw in 2025.
Right.
But if a Sunni kills an Alawite, he's not going to get punished for it. And there seems to be this massive invasion of tribal Syrians from the east into urban populations. And they're harassing women. They're conducting assassinations against minorities. They're stealing their property. And in fact, one of the ways this regime is financing itself, because you asked me about the economy, I'm sorry to go back to Syria.
No, it's fine.
There's a massive expropriation, but it's not a socialist kind of expropriation, which would be wonderful in the context of Syria, where they're taking factories or farms to put to the use of the state and the people. It's just the guys who came down from Idlib in late 2024 seizing it for themselves, as if they're trying to create a new political economy. And they perceive anybody who made money during the former regime era, regardless of how they made that money, you could have just had, you know, a fruit juice factory or owned a hotel. If you made money, if you lived in the government-held areas and you were made money, you are a target for them to seize your home, your car, your factory, and they've been doing that by the thousands. They established what they are calling the Illicit Profit or Illicit Gains Committee, and it's basically just a gang of guys, and they have, at the moment, 43,000 targets that they're going after to seize the homes, cars, factories, restaurants, hotels, of anybody they perceive to.
So it's a redistribution of wealth and property and in order to create a new economic base for the Jolani regime, it sounds like.
Right. Especially when you're unproductive and it's not like your economy is going to get better. It's almost like, it's like a feudal system where militias, former insurgents came back to their areas and they have authority to take whatever they want. Right. Now, if you get Jolani's attention or the attention of a senior security official, you can probably try to argue your case, especially if it's about seizing a home from just a university professor who maybe got his home from the university. But it's outrageous and it's alienating much of the population, including much of the Sunni population in the urban areas who resent the presence of these uncouth Idlibis or these Bedouin who are coming in. They resent the Salafi trend, which is also going after traditional Sufi Islam. Mm. In Damascus, most of the population would have had Sufi tendencies. But for Salafis and for other extreme interpretations of Sunni Islam, Sufism is polytheism. So they're going after their shrines and their practices and replacing mosque imams as well. So you see a society where violence is conducted with impunity and Sunni perpetrators aren't punished, where a muscular Sunni extremist, almost like Sunni Zionism kind of ideology is dominant, and the collapsing economy. I don't think the system is going to collapse, but basically nothing is going well in Syria at the moment, but it can persist and just be a poor, shitty, unstable country for many years to come. Because, as you said, there's no other threat to overthrow the regime. So anyway, back to Iraq.
Yeah, but thanks for. I'm glad you went back to that, because I've not read that anywhere. Like
it's clearly being blanked out.
Yeah,
but there was a euphoria when the regime fell. Yes. People, journalists descended upon Syria like it was, the Berlin Wall had fallen and we're all, this is a victory for everybody, like it's Tahrir Square all over again.
Yeah.
But media doesn't have a lot of money these days, and attention shifts as well. And now Syria is relatively uncovered in the news, and the coverage is very simplistic. Journalists who are working there now probably didn't work there prior to the regime falling, so they're... We saw the same flaws in coverage of Iraq in 2003 and Libya in 2011, that you show up not knowing anything and you rely on interlocutors who are fixers, translators who are self-interested. And there's a narrative of a dictatorship falling and freedom, which is not very accurate. Yeah. Yeah, there's no good coverage of Syria at the moment, unfortunately, in English at least.
So, sorry, quick curious question. The WMDs, you know, Trump and NATO bombed Syria twice under Trump's term on alleging that the Assad regime had used WMDs, you know, sarin or chemical weapons on its own population. And there are huge questions about the last one in Douma, where even OPCW whistleblowers came out and said, we found that there weren't WMDs used and it was suppressed and so on. But nevertheless, there was a, you know, massive, massive infrastructure of a kind of a web of government, NGO, media, Westerners and Syrian exiles and so on, who insisted that Syria had WMDs and this is why Assad was evil and this is why we had to go to war there. And then the regime was overthrown. And I did hear once or twice that the Jolani's people said, we're going to help you find those WMDs. But like, that doesn't even seem like there's any pressure. They obviously haven't found them, number one, as far as I know. And number two, there doesn't even seem to be any pressure. It's just sort of like, we all know that was a lie. Let's just move on.
I mean, Syria did have a chemical weapons and biological weapons program.
Yes.
And much of it was dismantled following 2013.
Right.
I do believe that the August 2013, August or September? I think August, yes. 2013, chemical weapons attacks were real or were conducted by elements of the regime.
Right, the Ghouta attack.
Skeptical. Yeah. And Madamia and Rota.
Right.
I've spoken to enough witnesses on both on the regime side and the opposition side.
Okay.
Or rather the opposition-held area side. I am skeptical about the 2017 and 18 mm-hmm. incidents. Those seem to have been false claims. Mm-hmm. It didn't stop Trump from striking. Now, the CIA was interested in what weapons remained, and they met with a general from a former Syrian regime who was head of the scientific research department of the military. Mm-hmm. And they concluded that, they did it here in Beirut, that he's full of shit, and that even if there's anything left, it's too complicated to be weaponized, so it's harmless stuff. Mm. And I think the Israelis, when they struck everywhere in Syria in December mm-hmm. of 2024, they destroyed most of what would be perceived as a threat by the international community.
Okay.
They were given lists of targets that they hadn't previously known about, and they just went around the country blowing up any military site they could find. There were some sites still left. Just for example, it's sort of a funny story. A few months ago, these Bedouin were looting a missile base that was right adjacent to a neighborhood in Homs. And they somehow blew up a missile that was left over. And
oops.
Yeah, but it shattered all the windows in the area, and people thought that there had been a missile strike. But anyway, most of the what was left of the Syrian military and its chemical weapons program were destroyed by the Israelis when their regime fell. So exactly so they wouldn't get in the hands of groups that would be perceived as a threat by the Israelis.
Okay, so thanks for answering that. But now let's move to Iraq, because this is a big part of the story. Iraq has also suffered a lot. In fact, I just saw a report that the Iraqi government has ordered a whole bunch of air defense systems from Turkey. I don't know what Turkey's, I think Turkey has, you know, interceptors, anti-air missile, interceptors, missiles. I don't know
anti-drone as well. The Turks have some good anti-drone stuff.
Okay. And I don't even know what it means to say the Iraqi government bought that. Does that mean the Iraqi government is protecting itself? The government is protecting itself from Iran, or protecting itself from the Iranian-backed Iraqi militias, or from Israel, or like who is what is even the Iraqi government, I guess?
Well, you have two governments. You have the central government in Baghdad, which its security forces were attacked by the Americans in this war.
Okay.
And there have been some Israeli attacks in the past as well. And you have the Kurdish regional government, which is a semi-autonomous zone in the north, which has been attacked by the Iranians and Iraqi Shia paramilitary units in this conflict and in the past as well. And so they would each have different reasons for wanting air defense, or at least different threats that they would be concerned about. So on February 28, when the Americans hit that school in Minab in Iran and killed 150 girls or kids, they also simultaneously hit several targets in Iraq belonging to the resistance factions and the Iraqi army. And they continued to hit Iraq almost every day, mainly with drone strikes and A-10 Warthogs that were launched out of Jordan in particular. What was strange about this wasn't that they were hitting the Iraqi Shia resistance groups, because they'd done that under the first Trump administration a couple of times, and even Biden did that a couple of times.
Yes.
Following the October 7 wars, when the Iraqi resistance groups actually also killed a couple of American, two or three American military personnel in Jordan in a base that we hadn't even known existed until the Iraqis hit it. So had they limited their attacks to Iraqi resistance factions, it wouldn't have been shocking for anybody, including those very factions themselves. Now, those factions hadn't done anything yet when the Americans first hit them. But it was known that in the event of a war on Iran, they would join in the so-called Unity of Fronts campaign, which also the Lebanese Hezbollah was engaged. And indeed, they did join in. And the Iraqi resistance factions, which is different from the PMF, the Popular Mobilization Forces, which is a government institution. You have these Iraqi resistance factions who are semi-outside any chain of command. They hit targets in Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iraqi Kurdistan and one in northeast Syria, mainly going after American military positions as well.
Were they responsible at all for taking out any of the radar systems or any of that stuff, or were they just keeping them pinned down?
I think in Jordan, yes.
Okay.
I'm not aware of the targets in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, but I know that they hit them. Mm-hmm. In the past, they've also hit the UAE prior to this conflict in order to get the UAE to change some of its provocative policies. I don't think they hit the UAE this time.
That's a long way. That's a pretty good distance for they're hitting them with drones or missiles?
Drones. From southern Iraq, it's not that far away.
Okay.
I mean, there are southern Iraq borders.
That's right, of course. Southern Iraq is Shia. And so, yeah.
Right.
Kuwait and...
Yeah.
And obviously Saudi Arabia as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, it might have been wrong for the Americans to attack the resistance factions, but it wouldn't have been shocking to anybody. What was shocking is that they also attacked multiple PMF bases and locations, and the PMF is a formal Iraqi security force which has not engaged in regional attacks or attacks against the Americans prior to this conflict or during this conflict. And they also hit the Iraqi army on several occasions and the Iraqi Sunni, the Sunni tribal PMF, which was a PM, it was a mobilization force that inherited the awakening groups of the David Petraeus surge era.
Right.
And was a separate anti-Al-Qaeda
forces, basically. Right?
Right. So these were anti-ISIS forces.
Anti-ISIS.
That became former. Well, they were anti-Al-Qaeda in the occupation days.
Right.
But they were revived and called the tribal mobilization forces.
Okay.
Which also answered to the prime minister, but were backed by the Americans. So these are Sunni forces which have no cooperation with
their American allies, presumably, basically.
You know? Yeah, the whole pivot from the doing America's bidding and helping wipe out Islamist forces in Iraq to something like abandonment of those forces with the killing of Soleimani, just to underline the fact that we're no longer friends. It was a little shocking.
Yeah, though I don't think anything should be shocking at this point.
I know, yeah.
No.
I'm surprised at myself when I get shocked.
yes.
Because, there's nothing matters anymore.
I know.
Rats are biting chunks of meat off of babies in Gaza right now.
Yeah.
Nothing is shocking, or should be. But yeah, I was shocked. I've been working on Iraq since 2003. that the U.S. would go after the Iraqi army. This is an army that the Americans created and trained and worked with closely. And only a month before they launched their war on Iraq and Iran, there had been a very effective and strong and close cooperation between the Americans and the Iraqis when it came to moving close to 6,000 ISIS prisoners that were held in Syria by the SDF, the Syrian PKK. They moved all of those Syrian and foreign fighters to Iraq. And this was a crazy thing for the Iraqis to do, because it's like you're taking in radioactive waste that the whole world doesn't want.
Right.
And the Iraqi cooperation was fast and was praised by the Americans. And then a month later, the U.S. is bombing the Iraqi army. It's fucking nuts. And nobody can explain why they were doing this. If they were only bombing, as I said, the Shia resistance factions, those are definitely enemies of the U.S. And it makes sense within the context of the conflict. But bombing Sunni targets, it was basically like anybody with a gun that they saw, they were sending A-10 Warthogs to go after them. They also hit the house in Mosul of the head of the PMF, a guy called Fadhl Fayyad, who had once been pretty close to the Americans, but Donald Trump put him on a sanctions list at the end of his first term. They hit civilian homes a couple of times in Baghdad, and after that, the Iraqi resistance factions went nuts and hit the American embassy. And then an understanding was reached whereby the Americans won't hit homes in Baghdad and the Iraqis won't target the U.S. embassy. And that held. But until the last day, they were still bombing targets in Anbar, Nineveh, Kirkuk, Salah ad-Din. And as I said, most of those didn't make any sense at all. They hit PMF guys who never were hostile to the Americans and had been fighting ISIS. They also hit the base of a Christian PMF unit and a Turkmen minority. The Turkmen are both Sunni and Shia, but there are Turkmen Shias who have a PMF units in Nineveh that fought ISIS very valiantly and have never attacked Americans. They killed some of those guys. So it didn't make any sense, but
It sounds like gloves off. It's the gloves off ideology that Hegseth was so proudly, you know, saying this is going to change everything. Yeah, it's going to make you stupider than you ever were. But a combination of the gloves off ideology, badassery, plus they're clearly getting some kind of, I would imagine, some kind of really bad intelligence from whoever has some skin in that game. So, you know, has a bone to pick with all of Iraq. I don't know who is feeding them that intelligence, because America's been in and out of there a long time.
Yeah, they were
time.
Hitting bases that they know that they helped establish. And the A-10 Warthogs circle over you very slowly, and they can see what the target is. I mean, it's a close air support for ground troops.
Right.
So it's not like it's a missile being fired from thousands of miles away or anything like that.
Right.
Nobody can explain it except that the CENTCOM viewed all Shias as an enemy, basically. Mm-hmm. And this was in a context of a general tension between the Trump administration and the Iraqi government, which had begun when former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki became the candidate for Prime Minister once again. You had elections in Iraq in November 2005 and a long, drawn-out government formation process.
You mean 25, or are you talking about the first one back in 2005?
2025, yeah. So,
okay,
I don't know, 8 months ago or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a long, drawn-out government formation process of haggling and negotiating and buying and selling of positions. And ultimately, former Prime Minister Maliki was backed almost by accident, but also he was perceived by many Shias to be the right candidate, both because only he could disarm the Shia militias and because there was a perception that Iran might become weak and we need a Shia strongman in Baghdad who can protect the Shias. Initially, these parties checked with the U.S. government to see if they had any opposition before nominating Maliki, and they were told, we have no problem with it. And then when Maliki was nominated, you saw Trump post a statement rejecting Maliki and threatening Iraq. And at the same time, the Tom Barrack, who was envoy to Lebanon and Syria and Turkey, seized control of the Iraq file and fired the former envoy, a legal marijuana shop owner from Detroit. It's not a joke.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah, so they fired the pot dealer and put the real estate guy in his place. Okay.
Right, and I think that the nomination of Maliki concerned the Turks, but Tom Barrack's main concern was Syria. Maliki had expressed hostility to the new Syrian regime, and
I see.
Barrack wanted him removed. Barrack actually met Maliki on February 27 to try to resolve their differences one day before the war happened. Maliki was willing to say and promise anything to get the Americans to back him. But obviously that didn't work out. But you saw a deterioration in the American-Iraqi relations. And right. So there might have also been additional reason to punish Iraq given the nomination of Maliki. A few days ago, a week ago by now, I think, they ended up nominating a different guy with no political experience, the country's most corrupt businessman, who was the money launderer for all the political elite. And one of his banks was actually sanctioned by the U.S. But Trump welcomed him nevertheless. So
It
seems like they struck
somebody that corrupt is somebody you can presumably have more control over or more influence with, I assume.
He does seem like a Trump kind of guy. But given that the parties who brought him to power are the same parties who nominated Maliki,
right.
It's not like he can act in defiance of them. He has no political base of his own.
Right.
No party of his own. So he'll still be beholden to the dominant Iraqi political parties, especially the Shia ones.
So the U.S. bombing all of these forces, government and non-government Iraqi forces, did that play a role in inflaming? Because Iraq seemed a lot hotter than I would have expected. And the Iraqi militias did much better. I mean, in previous engagements, the Iraqi militias, and maybe it's because they were holding back or maybe because they're still learning, but in previous engagements, let's say between late 2023 and I don't know, late 2024, early 2025, they did not seem very threatening. You know, they'd have the odd drone going off here and there once they got lucky hitting that CIA base in Jordan. But they didn't seem that threatening. And this time around, they seemed pretty effective and aggressive.
Yes, they too have learned, obviously. And they were also able to avoid major assassinations. The Americans bombed all of Iraqi targets, but they couldn't really successfully hit the Iraqi resistance very much. Because unlike the targets the Americans hit, the resistance guys weren't staying in bases or in their homes. This may also explain some of the American targeting. They were frustrated with their inability to find the actual targets.
Didn't they hit a leader of Kataib Hezbollah?
They did hit them, but they were unable to... most of the strikes were not against the Iraqi resistance factions, and they were unable to do much damage to them.
Okay.
But they did kill one of the leaders of Kataib Hezbollah in his home in Baghdad, which is what provoked the attack on the American embassy.
I see. Okay.
As a result, we also saw a significant American withdrawal from most of Iraq and a NATO withdrawal as well. So there is the relations are definitely damaged, and even constituencies that weren't hostile to the Americans are now bitter. In Anbar, for example, the Sunni population of Anbar, while in 2004 it was 5-6 was majority pro-insurgent, anti-American maybe. Following the ISIS wars, even before that, they had become very much pro-American, pro-Western, pro-Emirati, and more skeptical about Shias in Iran. So they were very provoked because it was their sons, many of whom were killed by the Americans when they killed Iraqi soldiers or Iraqi tribal forces. So there is increased hostility to Americans. One American journalist was briefly kidnapped for recklessly wandering around Baghdad after being warned not to. I've been warned as an American to wait a bit before I go back as well, because I would basically be the only American wandering around Baghdad.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. I think at this point we can look at wrapping it up. I'm sorry, I have one question, then we'll wrap up. What about the Kurds and all this? What are the just Kurds in Syria and Kurds in Iraq? I mean, the Iranian Kurds, for example, surprised everybody, especially the Israelis and the Americans, by very wisely refusing to act as the ground proxy to destabilize Iran. They, in general, seem to be pretty quiet everywhere. And I have seen Kurdish voices saying openly, every way they can, we've learned our lesson about the Americans, especially after Syria, and we're not going to stick our necks out for them for a long time.
Yeah, so early on in the conflict, there was an article planted that seemed like psychological operations, yes, stating that the Iranian Kurds in the Iraq-Iran border region were going to be used as, because there's a few former insurgent Iranian Kurd parties who have sought shelter in Iraqi Kurdistan. If you see them, it looks like they're out of the 1960s. Just a bunch of old intellectuals with AK-47s. So they would never actually be a threat anyway. But they were also not armed, and they weren't being prepared to attack Iran. And the Iraqi Kurds panicked because the last thing they wanted was a pretext for Iran or its allies in Iraqi Shia factions to attack Iraqi Kurdistan, which indeed they did. And they're also afraid of Turkey. Mm-hmm. So the Americans never did anything. The Israelis wanted it to happen. The Israelis told the Iraqi Kurds that they'll get Turkey to agree. Turkey, of course, would never agree to a renewed Kurdish insurgency anywhere in the region, because Turkey's been doing great, or things have been going great for Turkey since the collapse of the PKK project in northeast Syria.
Right.
And the Syrian Kurdish-controlled autonomous zone in Syria has shrunk to a tiny little rump in Hasakeh province, a fraction of what it was at the peak. And the PKK-Turkey peace process is also going along relatively well. Effectively, the PKK has surrendered in Turkey and relinquished some of its weapons and sent some of its fighters abroad. And as I said, the Iraqi Kurds didn't want any problems, and the Iranian Kurds wisely didn't get involved this time the way they did in 2022, when you did see some armed Iranian Kurd operations.
Mm.
So I guess that's the dog that didn't bark, or the dog that didn't bite.
Well,
over there.
The Iraqi Kurds have been naive cat's paws so many times that they finally got the picture that they were expendable for whatever foreign sponsor claimed to love them and advance their cause. I mean, I had an inside account of this from a woman who was dating a guy in the U.S. Security Services. And as I've mentioned before, she said, well, aren't these people just going to get killed? And he said, they're just animals.
Yeah.
That was his view.
Yeah. Yeah. Kissinger had some famous quotes about that along those lines too. But I would say at least the Kurds in Syria, despite being a minority and, you know, apostates, I would think, they're secular and have a leftist ideology and are, have sort of progressive gender politics. In spite of that, they seem to be being left alone still, more or less. I mean, they've had to essentially surrender, but it's not like what you see with the Alawites and the Druze thus far. Maybe it's because
there
it's
was
not
a lot
as
of pressure on There was a lot of pressure was put on the Syrian regime not to conduct massacres, and so they did kill civilians, but relatively few.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't much of a confrontation.
Right.
That helps explain it. The Kurds withdrew rapidly from Raqqa and parts of Aleppo and Deir ez-Zor and Hasakeh to the areas where they have the greatest concentration. And the Americans and Europeans made it clear to Jolani not to proceed any further. So his forces are quite frustrated that they haven't been able to fully take back territory, especially territory that has some key oil fields, like in Rumeilan.
Right.
But there is sort of a modus vivendi as well for now. And part of that is because you see so much Republican sympathy in Congress for the Kurds that Gulani knows it would be unwise to provoke a conflict that might lead to Kurdish death and might cost him as well. And CENTCOM is also putting pressure. There is still one camp left that's housing foreign fighters and their families. It's called the Roj camp. So even though they got rid of all the prisoners, and the Al-Hol camp, which at one point housed 70,000 mainly Iraqi and Syrian women and children from ISIS, those are now empty. The Roj camp is deeper in Kurdish held territory, and the West doesn't want those people to be in the hands of the HTS government in Damascus. Mm. So CENTCOM has also put pressure on HTS forces not to take over these areas yet.
Right. It still sounds a little bit, they still sound quite vulnerable, though. I mean, they're in a good place now, the Kurds I'm speaking of. But nevertheless, they have the Turks, you know, the mighty Turkish forces arrayed against them from the north. And although the Gulani government and its various militias have accepted a modus vivendi with them, it sounds like they're not letting it go by any stretch. And so it's probably a matter of waiting till the US is distracted or loses interest before making a grab. Not to be pessimistic, but that's what it seems like to me.
No, there's also the alternative theory that it's a matter of waiting until the US or some other party wants to use those forces once again.
Ah, yes.
Against Gulani. It's a right. possibility anyway. But definitely the PKK project in Syria, which they called Rojava,
yes.
has come to an end. It was, I think, romanticized sometimes in a very naive way. For example, they did have female leaders. There's no doubt about that. I don't know if I'd call it progressive because women weren't allowed to get married or have kids or have sex even. If you were an official cadre of the PKK.
Right, it's socially conservative, as I recall, yeah.
You had to dedicate your life to the cause.
Yeah.
And they had this crazy ideology, which is, one American official once described it as a mix between Scientology and Zionism. But, you know, it's a bizarre worship of Ocalan. That
okay, yeah, that part
of
was
Scientology.
Weird. But
but
sort
certainly
of the,
it's better to be a secular woman in in Kurdish held areas or secular anything, or a woman anything in their areas than it was in much of opposition and now regime held Syria. There's no doubt they were very unwise about how they negotiated. They were too doctrinaire, so they ended up losing everything when they could have held on to something had they been a bit more willing to compromise.
Yeah, and they did lose everything, essentially, when the forces that Turkey had assembled in waiting in the north finally moved south. I mean, I remember there was this story of a community activist, a woman who was yanked out of her car.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
That was just a bad
the
story.
Politician, yeah, there was a lot of that. The head choppers got to her. But there was also the sort of, I think, people who are looking for some kind of post-Marxist, but still kind of radical leftist politics were inspired by Rojava. I mean, you know, that Ocalan and the PKK had taken all of this influence. I mean, this is for another episode maybe, but I just want to mention, you know, from Murray Buchkin, who is an interesting writer and thinker, and I know David Graeber, you know, spent a lot of time there. I'm sure it was romanticized, but there was something beneath it too, I think.
Oh yeah, I lived there for a year in Soleimani, and that was not either a Barzani or exactly a PKK stronghold, but whatever it was kind of beautiful.
Soleimaniya in Iraq is definitely more socially liberal and open than Erbil, for example, the Barzani-held territory, which is more of a dictatorship and much more conservative socially.
Mm. Yeah. One of the gains of all of this is that Barzani, after having overplayed his hand in negotiations for about the 20th time, finally decided to withdraw to private life and spare Kurdistan his wisdom.
Well, his son and nephew are still in power, and the son in particular is a nail puller. I mean, he was head of security, so this guy probably has a lot of experience using pliers on fingernails.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Okay. There's always one more Barzani. That's just like a law.
Yes. Well, I think on that, I don't know what to say. This is definitely not a happy or a sad story. This is a story that's still in motion. And it's historically very significant because at the center of all of this is an empire in dangerous decline. And so all of these pieces are moving around erratically at the moment. And so thank you so much to Cyrus for helping make sense of some of this.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to make sense of a lot of it, but you're there and you have this great, very, very helpful, useful analysis and perspective on everything. So we can end the episode here. Thank you again, Cyrus, John, Brendan, and all of our subscribers, and talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.